Hello and welcome to our special series. We're live from New York this morning when the United States of America is still experiencing the shockwaves of what is being called the most stunning twist to an American election in decades. In fact, we are hearing again and again and again and again so many Americans actually saying that this is absolutely something that nobody could have predicted, not the pundits, not the pollsters, not the journalists, and perhaps not even the politicians themselves. What you're seeing on your screen are, of course, victory shots as Donald Trump accepted his victory with what some would say was uncharacteristic mellowness and grace, and even reaching out to Hillary Clinton, whom he has all along called crooked and corrupt and threatened to lock her up. But even as his own supporters were chanting, lock her up about Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump was talking about a debt of gratitude that the country owed her. Many believe that this is proof that Donald Trump may not be quite the president that his campaign suggested that he would be. Over the next 60 minutes, we'll be looking at the implications of this victory. The three most unlikely words for Donald Trump. President Donald Trump, the three words that Americans or many Americans thought they would never hear. Also coming up on the program in about 20 minutes from now, author, commentator, journalist, editor and founder of Women in the World, Tina Brown, is deconstructing for us exclusively the Donald Trump win, the Hillary defeat. You'll find out why she's calling Hillary Clinton a crashing bore and Donald Trump a congenital liar. These are big words coming from the always engaging Tina Brown, and my exclusive with her will be on in a moment from now. But first, let's take a look at Donald Trump's victory speech, one in which he promised to bridge the gap in an extremely polarized and divided America and said he would be a president for all people, not just Republicans, but Democrats and independents as well.
Now it's time for America to bind the wounds of division, have to get together. To all Republicans and Democrats and independents across this nation, I say it is time for us to come together as one united people. It's time. I pledge to every citizen of our land that I will be president for all Americans. And this is so important to me. For those who have chosen not to support me in the past, of which there were a few people, I'm reaching out to you for your guidance and your help so that we can work together and unify our great country.
All right, Donald Trump there, a compliment for Hillary Clinton, a promise to be president for all people. But now that he's let the genie out of the bottle, promised to send Hillary Clinton to jail, promised to build a wall with Mexico, mocked Muslims, mocked even disabled people, made fun of them, mocked a soldier who died in the line of fire and his family. Can Donald Trump really change his president? What sort of president will he be? And is this the ultimate Brexit moment for the United States of America? The backlash, as is being experienced in so many parts of the world. In fact, there's a global pattern developing, not just a lurch towards the right, but the emergence of disruptors, emergence of those who break status quo and who push back against the elites. Donald Trump always mocked Hillary Clinton for pulling in the star-studded power of Hollywood, saying he could go it alone because he had the people on his side. Was he correct? And what are the lessons for the world in this staggering election result? Let's introduce our panel today. We're joined by Patrick French, who's of course an author and columnist. We're also joined by Walter Anderson, who's with the Johns Hopkins University, Amy Kasman, South Asia Bureau Chief of the Financial Times, Lisa Curtis is with us from the Heritage Foundation, and Nelson Cunningham, who's of course been an advisor to President Clinton, will be on the program shortly as well. Walter, if I may start with you, this is not something that anybody predicted. I think even Donald Trump didn't expect it. He was talking till the very end about a rigged election. Ironically, in the end, it is this rigged system that delivered, rigged system in quotes, of course, that delivered him a victory. Hillary Clinton did not even come out to make a concession speech. She'll be talking in about 60 minutes from now. Nobody predicted this. What did the pollsters and the pundits miss here?
Well, as you know, I'm in India now, and I can tell you here as well, no one predicted it. And the program, which you may have seen this morning, where we started at 5 o'clock a.m. and went till 1:30 p.m., we started out the first hour and a half thinking, oh, we're going to be done at 10 o'clock. And it was clear that at about 9 o'clock, we were not going to be done at 10 o'clock. Something was clearly happening. And the newspapers here and all the news channels are filled with the surprise at what was happened and how it's going to impact on India. I think, you know, in terms of what little I know of and have seen Donald Trump, he is very much his own man. And it's somewhat hard to predict how he's going to run his government and, you know, how he's going to handle the issues that he confronts. The first of which is likely to be Obamacare, because he has said that one of the first issues that he will, handle on day one, if necessary, will be the Obamacare proposition. I think the interesting thing about Donald Trump, one of the reasons he had some problem and will continue to have some problems with the Republican Party or people in the Republican Party, he's not a conservative in the conventional sense of the term. He takes many stands which, in fact, many conservatives would find to be beyond the pale. And many conservative intellectuals in the U.S. have pointed that out. In fact, a reason for some not supporting him. So it's going to be interesting to see what kind of perspective that he puts down on key issues that he's promised to address, namely how to improve the lives of those people that he talked about as being forgotten and will not be forgotten in his administration.
Yeah, and you know, in fact, it's interesting, Tina Brown, who's coming up on the program later, was saying to me, I hope to God that he is actually a fraud, because if he actually begins to implement many of the things he promised to, then we're in for hell. And let me take that to Patrick. Patrick, it's being called the Brexit moment, the undercurrent that everybody missed or at least underestimated. Even when the polls suggested that it was neck and neck, the arithmetic was seen to go against it. You know, it's going to be debated. Is this misogyny? Or is it, you know, did misogyny trump all, or did jobs trump all? Was Hillary Clinton just not able to address the economic resentment of the white working class male who felt completely excluded from the political discourse? What's really going on here?
Well, I'm not convinced that this was about ultimately misogyny or about economics. I was in the UK during the Brexit campaign. And all the way through the US presidential campaign, I had echoes of this confirmation bias of the mainstream media not liking the idea of a Donald Trump victory and therefore tending to report it as if it was highly unlikely. But I think what we're seeing in the United States in Donald Trump's victory is a phenomenon that is extending right across the world and certainly across the liberal international order, which is a kind of reversion to the mean, where people go back to earlier versions of their own society, where it's almost as if people don't like the effect of change and globalization, and so they want to, in a way, turn the clock back. And when you get an insurgent populist figure like Trump, or like the leaders of the Brexit campaign in the UK, it's proved remarkably easy, much easier than we ever would have expected, for them to simply sweep aside the normal establishment politicians. And when I said I don't think in the end this is about misogyny or economics, what I believe it is about is identity politics being used, being applied to the white majority, the declining white majority of the United States, which by the middle of this century will become a minority. And again, it's not necessarily the people who are worst, who've suffered worst economically under globalization, who decided to vote for Trump rather than Hillary Clinton, but the one group which again and again was supporting Trump and took him to the White House was white Americans who feel on the back foot and are applying identity politics to themselves in a way that I think we could never have envisaged.
Now, Amy, that would bring in a larger question, and for liberals, not just in the United States of America, but liberals anywhere. I think liberals in India face this, and I use liberals in quotes as a political construct. They faced this pushback in 2014. Liberals in the United Kingdom faced this pushback during the Brexit vote. Liberal here in America has been a bad word or a contentious word for a very long time. But one would, one is increasingly seeing a kind of correlation between being liberal and being elite. That is what Hillary Clinton was in the end not able to shake off. She stood up to stand for inclusive politics, for liberal politics, but at the same time she kept getting classified as elite, as establishmentarian.
Barca, I'd like to say that, first of all, I completely agree with many aspects of the previous speaker, who basically said that this is a backlash by a class of people, by a white class of people, who are hankering for an older, simpler, more homogeneous America. I mean, the reality is the demographics of America are going in a different direction. They are looking backwards, but demographically, America is diversifying and will continue to diversify. So there is this kind of hunger and longing for a return to this kind of whiter, homogeneous America. I think Donald Trump very effectively tapped into that. But I also feel that there is an undertone of misogyny also that that is, in fact, maybe so deep-rooted that it's almost unrecognizable, but that the way Hillary Clinton was kind of tainted as this elite establishment figure, of course she was part of the establishment because she was a president's wife, but I think that the whole picture of Hillary Clinton cannot be disentangled from the decades of very sexist media coverage of her ever since she first entered public life as the highly educated, very ambitious, very outspoken wife of the governor of a conservative southern state who wanted to keep her own name, who wanted to keep working, who didn't want to just stay home and bake cookies, as she once sort of unfortunately said after becoming first lady nationally. But I think that the kind of resentment against what Hillary represented, which is really, Hillary represented, you know, a pathbreaker. She was on the first generation, that forefront of women after the 50s, which were an incredibly regressive time in America, after the 40s, which saw women entering in the workforce as all the male soldiers went off to World War II. Sorry, I'm getting a bit kind of digressed on history, but Hillary really was a pathbreaker, and there was a lot of resentment against that. And the dislike of her, I think, is the result of decades of that kind of antagonism by men towards her and what she represents, which is really the empowerment of women in the society and their demand to be treated in the public space.
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you. I think when Patrick says this is neither about misogyny nor about jobs, I will
Can
take
I just
that back
clarify
to you
back
because
at
it's
one point
at least
on
partly
I agree completely.
Yeah, I bring you in, Patrick.
I agree completely that there have been heavily misogynistic attacks on Hillary Clinton. But the idea that Hillary Clinton was a uniquely weak candidate, I don't buy at all. I think that if there'd been any other mainstream Democratic candidate, it is highly likely they would have been knocked out by President Trump. And what Trump tends to do is he will go after people on any basis. He will make a misogynistic attack. He will make an anti-Muslim attack. He will make an attack on a disabled reporter. He will use whatever weapons happen to come to hand.
Yeah, and I think you're saying there is misogyny, but that doesn't explain the result, and it's not the explanation for the result. Lisa Curtis, let me bring you in. I want to just share a little bit of a personal story. We were in Philadelphia reporting the Hillary campaign, and there was this white man who came out of a pretty posh bar and started talking to me, and in the course of this conversation, He started basically abusing Hillary Clinton. And when I said, you know, why are you abusing a woman? He started abusing me in return. And he said, you know, you're just talking in strange Indian to me. And I said, what do you mean? I think my English is better than yours. And we got into this strange argument. And then he was just absolutely, like he was filled with rage, of a rage I've never seen. I went to school in this city. I went to college in this city. I've never seen this kind of anger bordering on racism abusive racism, and he was really talking about this media being this monster machine for, you know, for Hillary, whom he abused in the worst possible words. Lisa, how do you see this result? I mean, how do you explain this anger?
Well, first let me say, sorry you had that terrible experience, and this is the kind of ugliness and divisiveness that our country needs to get beyond. Obviously, very divided country, very difficult election campaign. I think some people are just relieved that the election is over. Definitely a surprise, but I think that you also have the sense that major changes are coming to the United States. And the fact is, Republicans also have taken the House and the Senate. So there is a huge mandate for change in this country. And I think, you know, we should look at the concession speech that President-elect Trump made. He definitely sought to, you know, reach across the aisle, talked about healing the divisions. So I think we should, you know, look forward, try to get beyond this divisiveness that has characterized America over the last year. And, you know, I think if you're looking at foreign policy, you know, future of relations with India, you know, I would just note that there has been bipartisan support for a strong U.S.-India relationship. And Trump has said very favorable things about India and sees the importance of that relationship, the criticalness of India to the Asia pivot. So I see that momentum that has started in the India-U.S. relationship, really, which has been carrying on for the last couple of years, and has intensified in just the last six months with the listing of India as a major defense partner of the U.S., the logistics sharing agreement. I think, you know, he's likely to build on all of this. And so I think we just need to, you know, take a deep breath, realize that he's going to be surrounding himself with advisors, and that we're now beyond the campaign. And I think we should look at the concession speech as the way forward.
Right. That's interesting that Trump is actually not going to be that bluster and bombast, and the crazy things he said in the campaign is what I'm hearing you say, and the continuity of the Indo-US relationship. Let me get a quick comment from Avinash Iragavarapu, who is with the Trump campaign, worked closely with Donald Trump, was a key strategist. Avinash, welcome to the program. I think that's the key question. There were many things that Donald Trump said in the campaign that many people believe are simply not possible now. The wall with Mexico to just start with, maybe not even a reversal necessary of the abortion laws as they exist. He challenged NATO. He said climate change wasn't real and so on. Do you believe President Trump is going to be very different from Trump, the challenger to Hillary Clinton?
Thank you for having me on the show. Yes, I mean, President Trump is going to be, as he keeps telling us, like, he's going to be one of the best presidents. And, I mean, you can see it clearly yesterday in the speech. He was very gracious. He reached out to every person. He reached to people within the country, outside of the country, saying that he's ready to work with everyone. And he clearly said, you know, I need your support and guidance if you haven't supported me during this process. So I have no doubt that he's going to be one of the best presidents.
Avinash, let me build on that. You're actually saying that he's already reaching out. He's reaching out across the aisle. He's promised to be a president for all. Can I just ask you then, no wall with Mexico?
Now, look, I'm the executive director of the state party. I look after the politics, you know, the political campaign. So I'm not the person to talk on the policy front. But having said that, like, you know, people should realize that there's already a wall between Mexico, like, you know, there's a partial wall between Mexico and, you know, it's just like a border. As you have a border between India and Pakistan, there's a border. Like, you know, every country can have a border, you know, next to the other country. So there is nothing wrong in it. And in fact, when he was next to the Mexican president agreed that a wall is required. So it was not something which is completely new or something which is not existing. So, but he said that he's going to finish it, which has been started in the past. And it was very clear that he's not saying that. He said that in front of the Mexican president, they had a joint meeting. They came out, and in front of him, he said that we're going to build a wall, and the Mexican president agreed to it.
Yeah. No, I was just using it as an example to say, okay, how much difference is there going to be between the campaign and the presidency? And that happens everywhere in the world, by the way, but how different would it be? Nelson Cunningham, I have to bring you in and ask you, what mistake do you believe the Clinton campaign made? What did they not get? Was it that they did not have a distinct message? Was it that they misread the rage that I actually think Bernie Sanders captured to an extent, along with Donald Trump, the kind of resentment against establishment politics?
Hillary Clinton ran a perfect, perfect campaign on a technical sense. They had the best pollsters, they had the best ground game, they had the best outreach, they had the best digital media strategy, they had the best big data strategy, and yet she still lost. I think that Donald Trump, on the other hand, had a terribly sloppy campaign. He had only a few pollsters that were not very well known. He had a terrible ground game. He did not coordinate with the Republican Party. His digital media campaign was weak. Technically, it was a terrible campaign. And yet, he's the president. He clearly something that is happening in the country.
That's an interesting point you make, that one person ran a technically perfect campaign, the other person ran a terrible campaign, and yet he's the one who won. Let me, in fact, take that to Patrick. Patrick, what is it about Hillary Clinton that people kept saying, unlikable, unlikable? I kept thinking, if she were a man, would they judge her in the same way? And I'm sorry, I'm not trying to make excuses for her misreading the mood, but I still continue to feel misogyny is a huge part of it.
Well, I don't in any way dispute that there was a misogynist reaction to her throughout the campaign, and indeed that dates back right to when she first became directly involved in politics. The point I would make really is that I never accepted the idea that she was a weak candidate or that another mainstream Democratic Party machine candidate with her, with similar levels of experience, had that person been a man, would have won. I don't think this was about Hillary Clinton's failings as a candidate. I think it was about the insurgent campaign that Donald Trump led, and also the fact that there is, as I mentioned earlier, this reversion to the mean going on right across the liberal international order. And in America's case, that is being expressed in the form of an aggressive white nationalism, which you saw yourself personally on the streets of New York. I think that is something that is not going away. Trump did make a conciliatory acceptance speech, but I doubt that will last for more than a matter of days. If you look at everything in his past experience and his past life, he is somebody who fights, and he is somebody who turns very heavily against anybody who challenges him. And I think the real difficulty now is that because the American political system contains a lot of inertia, you cannot get things done quickly in the way that you can, for example, if you're a prime minister with a large majority in a country like the UK or a country like India. Right. There will be inertia within the system, and he, as President Trump, in 6 months' time, will be saying the people's will is being blocked. What about this institution? What are we going to do about it if it's going against the will of the people? I think there are very frightening times ahead of us.
Let me just give 15 seconds closing remarks to everybody else now. I'll start with you, Lisa. Brief closing words.
Just to say that, yes, in Washington, everybody is surprised by the result. But I think we have to recognize that it does herald changes in the U.S. And I think if we're going to take a cue, we should definitely take the cue from President-elect Trump's concession speech, which was about bringing the country together, moving beyond this divisive campaign that we faced over the last year.
Okay. I'll just get Avinash and Walter to very briefly make closing comments. Walter.
I'd like to agree with Lisa on that. She and I agree on a lot of things, but on this, I totally agree with what she said. I think what you had is something of a rebellion of the have-nots in this country. This is large groups of people, largely white males, who felt left out. Look at some simple statistics like the Gini coefficient, the difference between those at the top and those at the bottom. This has been increasing in the United States. And we have a lot of people who are really living on the margins, and that's something relatively recent, as have jobs and businesses have left the United States. There's a really frightening statistic I saw the other day, that the lifespan of many of the poor whites is actually declining in this country, which means there's something, you know, terribly wrong in what's happening. And I think one of the challenges that Trump faces is how to have a policy framework that addresses the issue of these people, and that's going to be hard to do.
Okay, let me just bring in Nelson. Nelson, one advice to Hillary Clinton going forward.
Hillary Clinton going forward? Well, I think she's got to take herself out of politics now. I don't see a path for her in politics. I see her going into perhaps going back and working on the Clinton Foundation, which is indeed a passion for her. I'd like to add one thing about U.S.-India, because most of the world is going to see a dramatic change in their relations with the United States, whether it's China, Mexico, Russia, Europe, Latin America. India will not. There is a bipartisan consensus on relations with India, and I think actually Donald Trump and Prime Minister Modi are going to find themselves in many respects cut out of the same cloth. So India is fortunate that this world-changing election has limited impact on India.
Right. Okay, Avinash, last word to you. We do know now that Hillary Clinton very marginally was ahead of Trump in the popular vote, but of course not in the Electoral College. A quick closing word to those who fear that Trump will be a divisive president, as his campaign was.
No, I mean, Trump is going to be a unifying president. We saw that clearly in the primary. It was divided, but he unified the party. I just want to react to the comment that, you know, the party was not working closely with Trump. Having been a person on the ground, I can tell you that we are one of the best efforts in Arizona. Even the Clinton campaign was investing $2 million, $3 million. We organized 12,000 volunteers, and we had 200 paid staff. We did one of the best campaigns in the modern world. And, you know, once he wins, people have to respect that and, you know, give it to him that he did one of the best campaigns.
I was just going to say the irony, of course... Yes, I was just going to say, Avinash, in any case, the winner takes it all. And the irony is, it's Mr. Trump who was initially talking about a rigged system. But you're right to make that point, that the victory reflects that there was indeed strategy in the campaign. And as a key strategist, you have every right to be satisfied. Thanking our panel now very much, Patrick, Amy, Walter, Avinash, Nelson and Lisa. Pleasure to have you on the program. Moving on now to Tina Brown and her take on the staggering, historic, really, really dramatic twist to the American elections, President Donald Trump. It's the morning after, and the news is still sinking in. In fact, for most people here I've been speaking to, they're still gobsmacked. There's a sense of disbelief. There's a sense of what just happened here. Well, if there's someone who knows how to deconstruct a really complex thing and make sense of it, it's my friend Tina Brown, author, commentator, somebody who's known not to pull her punches, and of course, the founder of Women in the World. A pleasure to have you on the Buck Stops here. Early in the morning, is it making any sense? Have you had any time to process what this result has been about?
Well, frankly, I've had a bad feeling through so much of the
last
year.
You did mention to me, I remember, that you thought there might be an undercurrent.
Because of Brexit. Ever since Brexit, we've all had this dread thought that actually the same thing could be happening in the US. And the fear that somehow Hillary wasn't taking hold, that there wasn't any embracing of her, really, that the excitement was being sort of hyped by others on her behalf rather than by her. As we saw in Philadelphia, we saw Michelle Obama and Barack Obama getting the crowds crazy with excitement, but then Hillary comes out and you just know that they're saying, okay, we will vote for her because you tell us to. This is the great tragedy, really, that she didn't manage to connect in that way and overcome this candidate for massive change, which is what Americans really want. In every poll all year, they've said change, change, change is more important to them than anything, any other topic, even than the economy itself, change.
So you're saying Hillary represented status quo, she represented establishment politics.
Alas, she did represent the establishment. She was totally demonized from the beginning by the Republicans, so badly demonized. And here we have to also talk about misogyny. I'm not saying that Hillary lost because she's a woman, but she experienced the kind of misogyny that everyone has been blown away by. Because the white male in America is at his most angry, the most vengeful, the most feeling of displaced, the most feeling of, you know, left behind. And here we have a woman who threatens that white male more than anyone. I mean, even when her polls were sort of doing less crazy stuff, 52% of white American men said they had a strongly unfavorable opinion of the Democratic candidate. That is 20 points, a whacking 20 points, more than Barack Obama ever experienced or any other Democratic candidate.
And I'm glad you bring up misogyny, because there's a kind of weird defensiveness about it. I've been having this argument with many of my friends, many of them male, ever since the result came, and saying, oh, come on, she didn't just lose because she was a woman. She lost because her campaign didn't have a message that resonated. I think, however, that this business about she was not likable, there's this thing that you say only about tough women that don't conform to a kind of feminine stereotype, and Hillary Clinton did not conform. So isn't she that also, part of the reason?
Well, part of it, but she was also terribly hobbled, unfortunately, by the baggage that she's accumulated both as a candidate and as a woman. Look, she made a lot of very bad mistakes. The emails were a terrible mistake. The foundation, I have said from the very beginning, she should have distanced herself from it.
The Clinton Foundation that her husband ran,
which was so fraught with all kinds of conflicts of interest, she should have distanced herself from that, not actually got further into bed with it. So she made a lot of political mistakes, yes. But there's also the facts of her life that she can't turn around. One of the issues for her, for instance, that was so difficult is that when Trump handed her an absolutely golden gift, which was his appalling tape, which had him groping women and boasting about sexually assaulting women, she couldn't respond with the kind of wonderful emotional climactic response that could have got her vote.
Why not?
Because of her husband's infidelities. Because all that happened was they would turn around and say, it's not as bad as what your husband actually did. Trump is boasting and speaking and bragging. Your husband had oral sex with a girl in the Oval Office. Who are you to talk about gross behavior? So she was sort of silenced. And it took Michelle Obama to come out and do that heartfelt speech.
But, you know, I think if Monica Lewinsky had happened today, a lot of us would have responded to Bill Clinton differently. I think in the 90s, he got more space to be, strangely, even from women who stood by him because they thought his politics were liberal, he got more space to be what he was. But do you believe that there is an equivalence in the gender politics then of Donald Trump and Bill Clinton?
Well, I think it has changed tremendously. I mean, there's no doubt that Hillary, alas for her, she's part of her terrible dilemma. She had to defend a president who she didn't always agree with by any means in Barack Obama, and she had to deal with her husband's 90s baggage, both of his sexual conduct and also, for instance, of things like criminal justice reform. I mean, Bill Clinton, at a time when things were very different in America, did three strikes and you're out, and would have, you know, the incarceration issue of putting people in prison. Now we know the incarceration policies of that time have led to a massive, you know, crisis in incarceration of young black men. So she's had to kind of try to walk away from that. All of these things that she was lumbered with made her more and more the establishment candidate. And also, let's face it, you know, we can talk about her weaknesses, but let's also talk about Trump's strengths, which we never do. We always talk about his weaknesses.
So let's talk about Trump for a moment, and we'll come back to Hillary.
He's a great communicator.
What was this about? How can the working class, blue-collared worker find affinity in a thrice-married Manhattanite who basically lives in a, you know, three-story penthouse in New York?
The thing about Trump is, and I've always felt this looking at his imagery, right? Yeah. When you look at his imagery, it's the Kardashian Camelot, I like to call it. Because, you know, voters are looking at this guy, whatever people say about how he made his money, how really he was a fraud, how, you know, he was a terrible businessman, actually, etc., etc. The fact is that people look at a guy with a golden tower and a private plane and a family who are all uniformly gorgeous. All the women in it look like ads for L'Oreal shampoo, you know, short skirts, long blonde hair.
I know, but it seemed almost like a kind of parody.
It's a parody.
Half parody, half manufactured, like you were on, you know, some version of the Truman Show.
Absolutely. It is pure reality TV.
Yeah.
But people like that. I mean, look at the most popular show is The Kardashians. I mean, people want that from themselves and their life. It looks successful to them. They want that.
Trump looks successful to people?
He looks successful. He looks like he had it all. He looks like a guy who has a golf course and a tower and a beautiful wife and a daughter who looks like the same. I mean, it's just an amazing image.
But he was also the butt of so many scathing jokes. He was, I mean, you know, look at Saturday Night Live and how he was parodied.
He was parodied, but, you know, Trump is a great communicator. I mean, the fact is we all know what he said. I mean, he said, make America great again. He said, drain the swamp. He said, lock her up. He said, I mean, look, we can think of five or six things that he kept saying, which did resonate tremendously. And the fact is that people cannot say the same about Hillary. At the end of the day, Stronger Together, which was her campaign, slogan, which was a kind of a poll-tested slogan they wound up with, has in itself a timidity just about it. It's like Remain in Brexit.
But Tina, explain this to people, right? You run Women in the World. One of the things I routinely get asked when I'm a part of it is about gender rights in India. And I would turn around this year and say, the American people just elected a president who has been accused of sexual assault. You know, about 17 women have come out and made different complaints. He has been on tape virtually legitimizing groping women, grabbing them by their private parts. He has referred to television anchors as having their period to explain his disagreements with them. He's used the word pig for another woman. This kind of institutionalized public brazen sexism, the fact that it's acceptable, what does that say?
I think it's tragic. I think it's incredibly sad, as is his absolute overt racism. All of these things are shocking to me, that a huge number of Americans, you know, predominant number of Americans, have actually decided to look past that. How can you look past such things? They have looked past it. So the question is, why? And, you know, the fact is that the other things about Donald Trump resonated more. And I think there was a
what
sense...
What was his greatest...
His greatest resonance for them was a sense, a can-do guy who was going to change the status quo. And that's what people want. People are deeply afraid in America of what's happened to them. People feel that they've really lost traction. And he may be a false prophet, but he is the prophet of that. And what I do feel very concerned about is what is going to happen to those voters who have really believed that he's going to deliver this change, who really believe that he's the guy who's going to make America great again, and actually find that he's all a fraud. Where's their anger going to go then? There's going to be a deep disillusion from his voters when they find out that actually he can't deliver anything that he says. But right now, he's the medicine man, and he says he can deliver these things. And if you look at the people talking about him, they say he's going to make, you know, he's going to make America great again. He's going to bring back America. They keep saying, we're taking my country back.
But do people really believe he's going to build a wall with Mexico?
I think that in a way, they don't really care so much about that. They seem to feel that he's going to restore their sense of themselves as the country that's on top. He's going to restore the economy. He's going to bring back jobs. And of course, as we know, he cannot bring back those manufacturing jobs, because what they're also being hurt by is not just globalism, which is obviously hurting them and which obviously has not been addressed in terms of the fallout to so many people, but also the digital disruption, which has really taken away so many of the jobs that the blue-collar worker has done. I mean, when Uber comes along and does ride-sharing, and when you have the driverless car, think how many truck drivers, long-haul truck drivers, are going to be put out of work, probably within 5 years. Yeah. That's a massive amount of people who won't have a job. That isn't going to stop with Donald Trump. People aren't going to stop.
Why could Hillary not find any resonance with these voters?
I think that Hillary never stood for, you know, disruption. She can't stand for disruption. She is the very definition of the establishment. And unfortunately, everything she did had played into that narrative. You know, the speeches for Goldman Sachs, a big mistake. I mean, Goldman Sachs has been tagged as the vampire squid of the banking industry. I mean, her left-wing supporters, it's like a cuss word. Yeah. You know, and she did 4 massively well-paid speeches, which she wouldn't release.
Why do you think she would not release them?
Because if she had, at the time of the primaries, it would have fed into exactly what Bernie Sanders was saying. When they finally were released, she did say, I dream of, a hemispheric open borders. I dream of open trade. I mean, you know, she obviously was saying the very things that Sanders was fighting against. So she could not release those.
But why was it that Hillary was not forgiven for not releasing her Goldman Sachs speeches, but Trump was forgiven for not releasing his tax returns?
Well, I think that what Trump has perfected, I mean, we all know about the big lie theory, which is, you know, has been forever in politics. But he's developed the huge lie, right? He's realized that everything out of his mouth really was false.
Everything. Have you heard Trump saying one truth?
I really haven't. I mean, he just created an alternate universe. It was such a big lie, such a massive lie, that it literally constructed a whole other world. And now the voters are living in their very own North Korea. For their last year and a half, they've bought into this alternate universe constructed by Trump and amplified by the alternate right media, which has become the mainstream media, frankly. And so they're living in this other world. And they don't understand that everything he says is a lie, and they don't really care. Whereas Hillary's sort of drip, drip, drip of her, you know, regular old political misdemeanors, regular old political, you know, sort of unfortunate mistakes, they're built up into a massive lying narrative, while his actual lies are built into he tells it like it is.
So you're actually saying that the next president of the United States is a congenital liar?
Yes. I think that Trump is a congenital liar, a fabricator of a world. Now, I mean, can he change? Well, I don't think he's going to change at the age of 70.
But did you see how after calling her Cricket Hillary throughout the campaign, he said we owe a debt of gratitude to her? So he's already changing his tone.
That was a relief. Now, it could well be, let us hope, and let us give him the benefit of the doubt, that Trump manufactured all of this, you know, stink bombs that he threw to cut through, that he understood better than anybody that social media requires constantly being fed with sensation to break through. And he fed it. He just threw red meat into that social media day and night. And it did break through.
But social media is a cesspool of toxicity anywhere in the world, right? Are you saying that, and this is an interesting question, that when Michelle Obama said, when they go low, we go high, Hillary Clinton didn't actually go low enough?
I don't think that Hillary could. I mean, ultimately, she was a 20th century candidate in a 21st century world.
And Trump was?
And Trump, you would think, here's this, you know, old 80s, what a, you know, talk about a retrograde figure. But he did master the new media. He, don't forget, he is a successful reality show host. His show was very, very successful. He understands the medium. He understood Twitter. And he would throw out this red meat onto Twitter. He dominated the airways day after day after day, because it was irresistible to be covered. There were whole weeks when you hardly saw Hillary on your TV screen.
But the mainstream media was not kind about Donald Trump. In fact, many of them had run-ins with Trump. So speak a little bit about the fault lines in the media coverage of this election, right?
Well, I am deeply critical, actually, of the media.
Why?
In this election. Because I think that they gave him a free pass for too long and finally got onto him too late. The investigative reporting that came out in the last quarter of his run was too late. It's amazing how already people's minds had been made up and it was too late to start dismantling.
So why do you think the media was kind to him?
I think that honestly, they, like everyone else, found the sensational stink bombs just so much more entertaining. You know, Hillary's a boring story. That's one of the reasons why she lost last time.
What do you mean by she's a boring story?
She's an old story. People don't want to hear about the Clintons anymore. They know everything about Hillary Clinton. She hates the press. She doesn't give sound bites. It's a drag covering her, you know, because she doesn't want to give you what you want, which is the loose canon words, the new idea. It's a chore to cover Hillary because she's just a buttoned up, smart woman who's getting on with her job. There's no copy there. There's no TV media there. Trump, meanwhile, was one big fireworks show. It was just divine for reporters. I mean, they couldn't believe their luck. The ratings went right up. That, you know, every time he came on, you got a huge audience. Hillary did not deliver that. I'm afraid, you know, media likes audiences, and they kept on putting him on, giving him the airtime. I mean, there were times on CNN where you would have a split screen and there would be Trump. His entire rally would be up there.
But here's the irony. He kept attacking the media. He kept saying the media is part of the rigged system. He hated the media. And he kept talking about suing the New York Times. Okay, that was towards the end. But throughout his campaign, like, and this has resonance in many different parts of the world, what we're seeing is a global lurch to the right. We're seeing an alternative narrative on social media, and we're seeing smart politicians who are actually able to bypass mainstream media and get right to where they need to go by crafting their own narrative. Why did Donald Trump hate the mainstream media if you believe the media was too kind to him?
Because Donald Trump is all about just aggression and attack. And don't forget, he has the thinnest skin in the world. So if anybody so much has, you know, levels of criticism against Trump, they get this barrage, which is one of the things I think we have to most fear now, is when he's criticized as president, people are going to feel scared to criticize somebody who will go on the offensive, you know, with social media at such velocity. So in that sense, you know, he understood. He also understands that the media is deeply unpopular with the American public at this point. And so attacking the media has always been a big winner. But also, let us not forget just how you know, unhappy Americans have been in the last few years. And I mean, you know, we had Bernie Sanders' success.
So if Sanders had been the candidate, because I met a number of, like in Philadelphia, I actually met Sanders supporters who were going to vote Trump. And they gate-crashed the Katy Perry concert for Hillary Clinton, and they told the media that, listen, we don't like her, but we were once Democrats. So how do you make sense of that?
Because I think that there are things that Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump dovetailed on. You know, the anger about being left behind, the sense that, you know, the global deals were being made, the trade deals had left people behind without jobs. And, you know, in that sense, they had that same message together. And then when Hillary sort of tried to adopt that, when the Sanders voters pushed her in that direction, it felt like a poll-tested stance where, you know, she had never taken that stance until that moment. And now here she was. First of all, she had been in favor of the TPP trade deal, this Trans-Pacific trade deal. Now, you know, after Bernie Sanders was against it, she's saying, you know, I'm against it now. It didn't resonate as authentic. And I mean, there really is, we really have to feel, you know, tremendous understanding of how angry people are. I mean, they have been stiffed, let's face it. I mean, the American financial crisis, the banking crisis in 2008, people have not recovered their incomes from that time. People are doing 2 and 3 jobs to earn just a bit less than they did then.
But what of the diversity of the United States of America? Where were those voters? You know, when we heard about the huge Hispanic turnout, the Latino vote, in early voting, everyone thought this is going to be an advantage for Hillary. There was an assumption that African Americans, and most of all, there was an assumption that women, even Republican women, would come around to Hillary. What happened?
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, I think that the African American voter feels that nothing good has happened to him for the last eight years. And they loved Barack Obama, but they just, you know, they don't have the same resonance clearly with Hillary. I mean, first African-American president brought them all out, you know, 90% of them. That was not going to be true of Hillary. Many of them just didn't vote. The Latinos...
Even though they knew that the alternative was Trump.
Yes, I think that they just... there was such a deep disgust that there are many people who sat on their hands. We don't yet know what's happened with that Latino vote. I mean, we were told that they were flooding to the polls in Florida. I'm not sure what happened yet.
Yeah.
It's too early to know why the Latina vote didn't seem to carry the day after what Trump has said about them.
Yes.
But, you know, the Latina vote is not a monolith either. And I think a lot of what Trump said probably did resonate, you know, with Latinas who have, who have much more conservative values. I mean, the social values of many immigrants are very conservative, you know.
Donald Trump doesn't have conservative social values.
No, but he was talking about the Supreme Court, it's a fake position, but he has said, I'm going to elect conservative judges who are going to take a stance against abortion. And here we have a situation already where we only have 8 Supreme Court justices because they won't confirm the 9th. We may be looking at a situation where we have 2 now Supreme Court judges in their 80s who are going to have to be replaced. They're going to be replaced either by incredibly conservative judges, because that is what Trump has promised, and we will lose the right to have an abortion as a woman, or they'll be stymied and you'll have a Supreme Court with 6 or 7 people on it. I mean, this is going to be the next huge fight, is the court.
But, you know, a number of Trump supporters I met said, oh, come on, he's just acting, he's just an entertainer, he's just an exaggerator. Even among his own supporters, there's a sense of filtering out some of the noise around him, and they actually believe he's, maybe because, as you said, you called him a fraud, he's not going to be what he said he's going to be.
Well, I think there is definitely a hope that that is true.
Ironically,
However, yes, I hope he's a complete fraud. I mean, that's what I'm hoping. And that when
he's
a complete fraud, and that now he's in office, he can relax and say, you know what, I didn't really believe that about the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
But what about the genie that he's let out of the bottle? I mean, his supporters at his rally last night were still shouting, lock her up, about Hillary Clinton.
Yes.
What are they unleashed here? This is like the Witches of Salem, where they used to dunk women who were different in a chair in the river, or worse, you know, burn them at the stake. He has unfortunately let a genie out of the bottle. And the question is, how do you get that genie back? I mean, is he going to be able to do that? Is he going to become the peacemaker? Maybe. We have been surprised by much in life, and I think we have to give him the benefit of that doubt, that he will now dial it back. But, you know, he's been so out of control, they had to take away his Twitter account from him.
Yeah.
And as Barack Obama said, you can't trust a guy with a Twitter account, how can you trust him with the nuclear codes?
So what does this say about the Obama legacy? Because it was unprecedented to see the kind of support that Obama, 17 rallies for Hillary Clinton. Michelle Obama, who was in some ways a contrast as first lady to Hillary Clinton. Remember Hillary famously saying, I'm not, you know, one of those who's going to bake cookies. Michelle was actually quite happy for a long part of her tenure being the mom in chief, as she described herself. And she really emerged into a political being in this campaign. Is this a statement on the Obama legacy as well?
Well, I think the Obama legacy may be the first black woman president. I mean, it seems to me that Michelle Obama
is going to break the glass ceiling that Hillary couldn't.
She is so beyond impressive, has such an ability to connect, is so loved that if she has any political ambitions, but she firmly says she does not, she has it all, and there's going to be tremendous pressure on her, and the only thing that might make her change her mind is defending her husband's legacy, because, you know, Trump has basically pledged to dismantle the Obama legacy, starting with healthcare.
But if she was so popular and Obama's approval ratings are pretty high right now, why could their support not bring out the vote for Hillary?
Listen, every movie star, rock star, and most popular person in the world came out in favor of Remain campaign in Brexit, right?
Yes.
It didn't matter. People didn't care. In fact, as a matter of fact, I think it added to the sense that, look, the establishment will want her. We don't. We don't. There's a kind of cynicism about that. You know, Jay-Z can give a concert with Beyoncé. Everybody goes.
Yeah.
But they like Jay-Z. They didn't go there to vote for Hillary Clinton. And this is the question of the celebrity surrogate, even when it's someone as popular as Obama. Obama was magic in Pennsylvania. I've never seen a performance that was more charismatic. He was like nostalgic. And when he said, are you fired up? And we all remember 2008, fired up, ready to go.
Yeah.
It was such a, it was very moving to be reminded of all that hope that we'd had in 2008. But look what kind of a presidency he's had. He's been obstructed from the moment he got in, delegitimized, told constantly that he didn't even have the right to be president because he wasn't born here. I mean, the whole birther movement, in which Donald Trump himself was such a prime mover, he's faced nothing but an attempt to delegitimize his presidency. And here we are at the end of it, and he is still so incredibly popular, but the people that he moves are voting for him. You know, I don't think you can move your vote to someone else. It's never really worked.
So explain this. How did Trump get away? Gender, I can understand. It's difficult to get people worked up about gender, unfortunately, though many of us try. But he mocked a soldier's family. You know, you had Khizr Khan making that incredibly moving video. You know, the military is beloved of the right and the left and the center here. How did he get away with that moment?
You know, I think that people have decided. I mean, today I was buying a newspaper, and the guy in the newsstand, he said, what's the matter? I said, I'm feeling depressed. He said, he's okay. I said, really? He said, yeah, he talks too much, you know, shoots his mouth off. That's bad. But you know what? He's going to make change.
Tina, I have to ask you in the end to bring you back to Hillary. You said we forget about Trump's positives. We keep focusing on Hillary, but misogyny. How much of this is about her being female? Why is it so tough for the American people to have a woman president? And when you think about it, I'm thinking of what one of the Clinton supporters said to me. She said, you know, Trump supporters are more scared of female authority than they are of Vladimir Putin. So that's how she saw it.
I think that is true. We saw, and this is what's so sad, when Hillary was in the debates, every time she aced it.
Yeah.
She was a superb, clearly qualified commander-in-chief. But when you think about those debates, they were the only times she was ever allowed to talk about serious issues. For the entire campaign, Hillary was being demonized or having to defend herself about the emails. And the remarkable thing is that there were, you know, 36 minutes on television throughout the entire campaign in total devoted to policy. If she had been allowed, as she was in the debates, to talk, or in the Benghazi hearings when she was grilled by the Congressional Committee for 7 hours, everybody came away blown away. That's when her poll ratings would go right up. People would say, oh my God, she's so smart. She's so competent. And you just wanted to say, that's right. That is who she actually is, if she's allowed to speak.
So who's not allowing her?
Well, the media actually completely tormented her about the emails. You know, whatever she came on to talk about, that's all they wanted to ask. But I do think the misogyny is a huge part of it. I think people don't like in America, the sight of a strong woman winning. And I think particularly at a time when American men are feeling so left behind, white men are so left behind, this woman represents the woman boss they don't want to work for, the woman who just took their job, the woman who's an elitist. They don't want her around. I have to say, I think that Michelle Obama may have a better stab at it because she has that incredible presence and movie star charisma.
And she has no baggage.
And no baggage.
Were you disappointed that Hillary did not come out and concede? It was so unlike her. In a way, one would have thought she could be tough in that circumstance.
I found it absolutely tragic that this woman who has braved, I mean, this is a woman, a fighter, a stalwart. I mean, the courage of this woman, whatever you think about her, different weaknesses, I mean, the courage. She was the one who was prepared to stand there like a punching bag for 14 months while these terrible things were said about her. And this thug made these awful, demeaning comments. You know, last week, a man actually, Sununu, the Republican former governor of New Hampshire, actually opened a rally by saying, do you think that Bill Clinton meant Hillary when he said, I didn't have sex with that woman? What a beastly thing to say about a woman, you know, approaching 70, who's a public servant, mocking this woman for being supposedly not, you know, sexually appealing to her husband. I thought, this is the lowest of the low. This isn't even, you know, one of the guys in a T-shirt saying, make America great again. This is a former chief of staff to the first governor of President Bush.
Scary.
I was absolutely heartsick that she couldn't come out. A woman who came out and said, we made 19 million cracks in the glass ceiling last time, and, you know, we're going to continue to fight and so on. She must have been brought so low by this. But I think she also knows, not only has she lost the election, but look what's ahead of her. I mean, she'll feel forever blamed for having, you know, lost the American idea of itself to a coarser,
It is really
harsher.
A difficult moment for her.
It's a very difficult moment for her. And her husband's foundation has been trashed. Her own legacy is now utterly sullied. It's a two-time failure. I think for her, it's a crushing moment where you want to put your arms around her and just say, you fought as hard as you could, and it just wasn't your time.
Yeah. In the end, what kind of president do you think Donald Trump is going to be?
I think it's going to be a wild ride and a very, very tough 4 years of pushback. I mean, we have Trump in charge of the, you know, as president. We have a Republican Congress and a Republican Senate. And as many as there were who voted for Trump, you know, there were plenty out there who didn't. And the sense of betrayal and rage and fear, a lot of fear. You know, I mean, people who are ethnic minorities, disabled people, very, very afraid of what Trump now brings, and the disappointment of young women.
Well, divided country, interesting times, as the Chinese would say, in not necessarily a positive way. Tina Brown, a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you, Barker.